nothing is more urgently needed than how to stay well. If we don't stay well, then of course we're going to have a lot of problems. And so our topic this time is how to be healthy. And I hope that some of the things that we study will interest you greatly, because some of them are things that there are some misconceptions about. And I am quite certain that not everything that I say, not being inspired, is going to be the absolute truth. But I will tell you this, that in every possible way that I can, I have studied every topic that I'm going to be presenting to you, and as well as I can tell, what I am telling you, it agrees with both science and inspiration. Those are the two things that we have that can I will climb out on a limb on either one of those two. It's a well done scientific investigation and inspiration. And then if we can properly interpret these two, we should be able to get a, if they coincide, then we should be able to get the truth. If science and inspiration disagree, do you know which one I take? I have always taken inspiration. Now I have lived 32 years in the Seventh-day Adventist Church, having practiced medicine 10 years before my husband and I became Seventh-day Adventists. And we have practiced in both manners, both as standard practice of medicine and in the what we might call the sanitarium practice of medicine. Of the two, my preference is the sanitarium practice. It is by far and away the most satisfying for a physician, because you can expect that people will actually get well of their diseases. When we practiced with drugs and surgery, you did not expect that the patient would actually get well, but rather that your drugs would more hold the symptoms down, and the patient would either never get well, or if they got well, they would get well in spite of the medication, as sometimes does occur. That's not to say there is no place for standard medicine. There is very, very much a place for standard medicine. And we're told by inspiration that the large use of meat will make it mandatory, make it a requirement that drugs be used in the practice of the healing arts. And so I do believe that. And then, of course, for injuries, we need standard medicine for injuries and very acute illnesses that require intensive nursing care or intensive monitoring. We need the standard medical care for that as well. So I'm not suggesting that we abolish standard medical care, far from it. And my husband and I and our colleagues who practice with us at UC Pines do at times need to resort to standard medicines. But every time we have to use a standard medicine, my feeling always is that our knowledge of physiology and anatomy and biochemistry is not sufficient to meet the needs of the case, and we have to rely on something else. In my opinion, our divine designer has made a remedy not only for every sin that we know, but for every sickness that could affect the human family. And the reason that we don't have remedies for such diseases as arthritis and multiple sclerosis and a number of other problems is because we have not been as faithful as we should in investigating these. And I sometimes think, well, what if all the doctors who had ever called themselves Seventh-day Adventists had devoted themselves, their whole lives, to investigating diet, exercise, sunshine, herbal remedies, hydrotherapy, and all of the other wonderful things that we have in nature, how much farther along we could be in the practice of the healing arts. Then, of course, there are some misconceptions that we have. Some of these are misconceptions that people have had from the beginning of our understanding of that particular thing, and some of these are misconceptions that have grown up. Take, for instance, this particular thing that we have right here. Let's get it in focus for you. And if somebody could elevate that this screen for us so that people will be able to see a little better. Could we get the screen pulled up to the its full height? Looks like that might be the best. Is that the best we can get it, do you think? All right. That's very good. And now we're not quite in focus. Let me see if I can get that a little better for you. Is that a little better? That better? Not sure exactly what is happening to make it so that it won't stay in focus, but well, won't stay in focus for you. Sorry. I think that's about the best that we can do. If someone doesn't mind playing with this focus apparatus here, be happy for you to try. Now, I'd like to tell you ahead of time that what we have here is one version of an annual laboratory test report sheet. There are many as there are laboratories that make tests on people. And this particular one is one that's an abbreviated one. It has 15 chemical tests on it, and it has also a white blood cell count and a hemoglobin and hematocrit. And I would like to point out that there are three things here that you can know. One is the abnormal, but then another is what the average American is. Now get this point very carefully, and that is that average American laboratory test result is not necessarily ideal. What we do to get the reference range is to take 1,000 or 10,000 people, put them through the laboratory, and if they can walk in and walk out, we assume that they are normal. And so we use that as the normal range. But as you know, about 50% of those that can walk in are going to be having a fatal heart attack one of these days. So we don't necessarily want the kind of blood cholesterol or triglycerides or any other lab test that they have if we know that there is a way that they are abnormal. So let's take a look at these. The first one here is that of calcium. For calcium, what is the reference range for average Americans is about normal. Same thing for inorganic phosphorus. But when we come to glucose or blood sugar, then what is average American is not necessarily the ideal. Because you will see laboratory test reports now that go down as low as 65 or 64 and go up as high as 115 or 118. And these are very clearly abnormal when we study the patient thoroughly. If we do an insulin test, if we do glucagon tests, if we follow these patients along for a long time, we find that they do become abnormal. So the objective then is that we could recognize an abnormal or an approaching abnormal test years in advance of when it is going to bring the person down with a disease. And at that point, we teach the person to make corrections in the lifestyle so that they won't come down with disease. This, of course, is true preventive medicine. And for in my way of thinking, preventive medicine is not just detection of a disease early. It is preventing the disease from occurring. So we try to predict when high blood pressure is coming and predict when diabetes or insulin resistance or hypertension. We try to predict when they're coming so that we can be helped by a change in lifestyle early enough so that we're not crippled with a disease before we understand that we even have a likelihood of developing it. To give you an example, we now know concerning blood sugar that the blood sugar may be kept in the normal range for years when it should not actually be in the normal range if we were checking the insulin levels. Insulin levels have to be much higher in some people in order to keep the blood sugar in the normal range. Well, what is the most damaging to a human being? Is it the level of the blood sugar or is it the level of insulin? Well, now we know if you'd asked this 20 years ago, we would have said the level of the blood sugar. But today we know that it's the level of the insulin because there is a quintuplet of diseases that go with an elevated insulin level. And here they are. One is an increased risk of heart attacks. Along with that is altered blood fats, cholesterol, and triglycerides. Second thing is obesity, particularly abdominal obesity. That's obesity in the tummy. Now, if you may have abnormal insulin levels and be overweight all over, but if you are skinny everywhere else but have a little pot belly, then you can be certain that you have a greater risk of having a derangement in your insulin level. Another of these diseases of quintuplets is that of hypertension. Another is diabetes. And the last one is cancer. These five go together as quintuplets. And we can identify people even when they are 2 or 3 years old if we check an insulin level. But insulin levels are expensive. In our area, they cost about $80 a test. Well, you can get a whole battery of tests, all of these tests and more too, usually for around $50 to $70 or so. So you can see that it's a very expensive test, requires special handling of the blood, has to be separated very quickly, and then it has to be put on ice until the laboratory gets it. So it requires very special handling of the specimen. So we don't do this test as often as we do the blood sugar. Everybody looks at the blood sugar. Oh, it looks fine. It's normal, in normal range. And so we forget about the fact that it could be abnormal. So if your blood sugar is anything other than 70 to 85, you already know that you've got a problem with your insulin. And even if it is between 70 and 85, you could still have a problem with insulin. Okay, the next one is BUN, or blood, urea, nitrogen. This is a urinary tract waste. And ideally, it should be less than, I like to see it, less than 15. And if it's less than 6, I'm not at all perturbed. Unless the person has evidences of protein deficiency or being undernourished. You can get too low a level if you're undernourished. But if the person is eating lots of salads, eating lots of vegetables and lots of fruits, and they still have and they're well nourished, they still have a low BUN, I'm happy. The BUN, blood, urea, nitrogen, is a waste product which the kidneys should clear from the blood fairly well. And all you would have in the blood would just be what is the present accumulation from your current metabolism of protein, not a buildup which cannot be eliminated by the kidneys or because you're eating too much protein or you're not getting enough exercise. These are all reasons why people do get a high BUN. Uric acid. I like to see the uric acid under 5. And the more under 5 it is, the more I like it. That indicates to me two things. One, that the it indicates to me that the that with a low uric acid, that the person's axis that has to do with diabetes and gout and heart disease is probably pretty good if their uric acid level is low, because uric acid is also somehow involved in this quintuplet of diseases that I mentioned, the hypertension, the cancer, the overweight, the heart disease, and the diabetes. Just exactly how uric acid fits in there has not been determined yet. This, to understand this disease is still a little new. But in our new book called Diabetes and the Hypoglycemic Syndrome, we talk about insulin resistance in there. And you can understand more about this disease by reading our book. You may have heard this disease called Syndrome X. Anybody ever heard that term? Syndrome X? That was coined about 20 years ago, before all 5 of these in the quintuplet were identified. Then cholesterol, the ideal cholesterol is about 100 plus your age. And all other things being good, we can tell you that a cholesterol of 100 plus your age will probably guarantee that you will never get a heart attack. There are a few other things that can give you a heart attack, but extreme stress can, and a high homocysteine level. Again, we don't do homocysteine levels much, but for people who are whose relatives have any of this quintuplet of diseases, it might be worth your while to spend the $120 to get the test to see if you are among those, because there are some specific things that we can do for elevated homocysteine levels to see if they are to see if the person is abnormal and needs to do some of those. Cholesterol, 100 plus your age. Now, cholesterol, as you know, is made up of 3 different kinds: HDL, LDL, and VLDL. What is HDL? High density lipoprotein. LDL, low density. VLDL, very low density lipoprotein. Which are the damaging ones? Well, which is the good one? HDL. How high would you like your HDL to be? Well, the higher the better. And on most laboratory tests, and I don't have it on this report, but in most laboratories, they begin at 35. But that's too low, in my opinion. I like to see it up around 50 or above in order for the person to feel fairly secure. 52, maybe 100 in most laboratories today. That's a good level. And if yours is not, then suspect that you've got this syndrome X, or the insulin resistance, or high levels of insulin. Okay, the total protein, albumin, and total bilirubin, alkaline phosphatase, and so forth, these are all as they are LDH and SGOT. These are liver and bone and tissue enzymes that help us to know something about the general way that the person person's health is. Triglycerides, ideally, should be under 100. If they're under 100, then you're likely to be doing fine. If you are a vegetarian and you eat a lot of fruit, then you may have a level that's higher than your age. If your level is around 100 and you are a vegetarian, eat a lot of fruit every day, then when you're 120, your level will still be around 100. But if you're a meat-eating person and your level is around 100 and you're maybe 30 to 45, by the time you're 60, it's likely to be 250 or 350. So if you're a vegetarian, it could be up around 100. Okay, the next one is the T4. That's a thyroid test, and it is as it's listed on the test. WBC, or white blood cell count, I mentioned this morning that 2,800 to 5,500 is probably the ideal. Vegetarians have lower levels of white blood cells than do others. The reason for this is that vegetarians have cleaner blood than do others, and if your blood has substances in it that the body looks on as being something needed to be cleared out, then of course it calls on the bone marrow to give you more blood cells, and you carry extra blood cells. Well, isn't this fine? Don't we want a lot of blood cells floating around? Well, in disease we do, but in health it's like the pulse. In disease we want the pulse to go up, but in health we want the pulse to be low. It's the same thing with the white blood cells. If you're in good health, then we want to have a nice low white cell count. And the more elevated it is, the more it points to some kind of disorder in your body. Hemoglobin, for women, 10.5 to 12.5. And you will often find doctors giving iron if the hemoglobin in a woman is 10.5. What about the levels that are usually given in laboratories? For women, up to 16 grams of hemoglobin. For men, up to 18 grams. This is far too high. And all labs are bringing these down now. You need to write these levels down because they won't be anywhere. They aren't printed anywhere except in our books. They are printed in our books. Our book, Nutrition for Vegetarians, has this ideal sheet on the last page. With the hemoglobin for women, for anybody, the higher the hemoglobin goes above the ideal, the greater your risk is for having a stroke, a heart attack, and cancer. Why is that? Well, it has to do with the immune system. It also has to do with flow characteristics of the blood. When a person is going to have a heart attack, if we will check the hemoglobin, if we check the hemoglobin of all of us here in this room every day for the next many, many years, those who are going to have a heart attack about 2 days before their heart attack is going to strike them, their hemoglobins would start going up. And this is one of the predictive things for heart attacks, but of course you have to be checking the hemoglobin every day. And very few of us get our hemoglobins checked any more frequently than once a year. So now, whatever your hemoglobin is today, if it's too high, then put yourself on the blood donor list for the Red Cross. Every time they'll let you go, you go down there and get your blood. And don't go down and say, a doctor told me I needed to come down here and give my blood. Because those of you who have worked in blood banks, you know that if anybody is sick, we're not going to be taking their blood to give to somebody else. So you have to go, and if you can answer all their questions truthfully, then you'll pass the donor questionnaire. But if you say, Dr. Thrash said, because my hemoglobin was 14 grams, I needed to come down here, they will either not take your blood or they will charge you for it. Because then it's called a therapeutic phlebotomy. Okay. For men, the ideal hemoglobin is 12 to 14 and a half. As it gets higher, don't forget that it increases your risks for some very terrible diseases. Any questions about this particular handout? Yes? For females, 10.5 to 12.5. What about during pregnancy? What should the hemoglobin be during pregnancy? Should it be as high as it is when a woman is not pregnant? The answer is no. it almost always falls. Normally, it always falls during pregnancy. The reason for that is that our all-wise divine designer made us so that during pregnancy we would stash away 3 units of blood plasma during pregnancy. If there were nothing else in all of the human body to make me believe in a creator, this one thing would do it. Because within minutes of her passing the placenta, this plasma is going to be coming back into the bloodstream. She gets a transfusion of 3 units of plasma. I consider that a miracle of divine engineering that I am not to fight against. And furthermore, it has been shown that the ideal hematocrits, which is essentially 3 times the hemoglobin, ideal hematocrits for black women, 29 to 31. For white women, 30 to 33. These are ideals. A woman will have fewer complications of labor, delivery, and postpartum period if her hemoglobin is in that range. And so I'm always disappointed when a woman tells me that her hemoglobin is 11 grams, she's 8 months pregnant, and the doctor is very worried about her, giving her lots of iron supplements, and he doesn't appear to know that she should be lower in hemoglobin. And he should know, because we're all taught that in medical school. Okay, let's go on to the next one, unless you've got a question about this. 1 and 2. These two, yes.
Homocysteine, is that primarily
in meat? Homocysteine, no. It can be in total vegetarians, too. It is a metabolic problem that some people have, that if it is elevated, the homocysteine tends to irritate the interiors of blood vessels. We can call it irritation. Tends to irritate cells. We can speak of it in that way. And in this way, it causes an increase in heart attack risk. Homocysteine. That's HOMOCYSTEINE. Question number 2.
My question is, does giving blood,
yes,
stimulate the hematocrit?
Does giving blood stimulate the bone marrow to produce more blood? And the answer is yes, it may. So you need to take measures to make it so that your bone marrow is not producing more blood cells on as a usual thing. What makes us get too much hemoglobin? We call it stress polycythemia. Stress polycythemia. Stress of any kind, whether it be biochemical stress, that means from being the body's chemistry is stressed for some reason. Overeating causes a biochemical stress. Being overweight causes a biochemical stress. Exercising too much causes a stress on the body. And, of course, all sorts of heavy loads on the mind can cause stress, which can give us stress polycythemia. Question? The question is, I didn't remark on the T4. That's a thyroid test, and the reference range is the same as the ideal. For those that I didn't specially comment about, the ideal is the same as the reference range.
Well, if people from whom
these levels come from could be any level of health, could it not be that the thyroid could also be deranged in this group?
Do you see subclinical hypothyroidism?
Do we see subclinical hypothyroidism? Actually, I like to see the thyroid function on a fairly low side. Because if the thyroid is functioning at a high rate of speed, that means that metabolism is revved up. And particularly as we get older, I like to see the thyroid function be a little on the low side. And let me tell you a story that will illustrate this. When I was in medical school, I had a little job at the Georgia State Institution for Mentally Defective People. We had about 1,500 inmates there, and we had physicians who took care of their needs, but there were three of us medical students, senior medical students, who ran a clinic for these youngsters. We had all sorts of interesting cases there. And one of the things that we did in running the clinic, the three senior medical students, we had already had our clinical work, but we were very inexperienced and worked under senior physicians in the clinic. And we took care of all that. We sewed up all the little cuts and took care of the colds and the sore throats and the runny eyes and ears and noses and so forth. Did a lot of minor work there. And one of the things that we did was to be the primary physician for the staff as well. And then because the staff, we sort of felt, could sort of watch over these medical students, and if they did anything wrong, they could report that their illness was not taken care of by the medical student. So one of the patients that I was called out of bed at night for was a man who had what is called cardiac asthma. His heart was not strong enough to make it so that he could keep his lungs free from fluid during the night. So when he'd lie down at night, from time to time, he would get the asthma. And of course, he would be just really panting for breath. So his son, who was the employee, he was the dependent of this his son would call and say, "I'm bringing my father in. He's in real bad shape." So I'd meet him over there. I'd have my aminophylline all ready. I'd give it to him, and he'd breathe better within a few minutes. Of course, the aminophylline was dangerous for him, and so I got to thinking, this man needs to go to our clinic. He'd been followed by an old country doctor way out in the podunk of near Augusta, Georgia, where I went to medical school. This old country doctor, I felt, was probably behind the times, and that if the clinic where I was getting my training took care of this man, they wouldn't be disturbing my sleep about once a week and making me get up and run over and give him this dangerous medication. So I said to the man one time while I was waiting for the aminophylline to take effect, and he was standing there and I was waiting to make sure that he didn't get any real bad result from taking the aminophylline, I said, "You know, if I were you, I would go down to the clinic where I was being trained and I would let them work on me, because I believe that they could adjust you with a thyroid supplement. And they could help you with adjusting your medication, give you a little bit more of your digitalis. I believe they could really stabilize you so that you wouldn't have this cardiac asthma." He said, "You think so?" And I said, "Yes, I really believe that old Dr. So-and-so has just had his office about 5 miles. I think he's behind the times on this disease." So he took my advice and he went down there. They adjusted his thyroid level just as I thought they would. They adjusted his digitalis level just as I thought they would. And I didn't hear from him for about 2 weeks. Then one night, his son called and he said, his son's wife called, and he said, my husband has taken his father. They're in a big rush. He's in a bad way this time." So I went running over to the clinic, and when I got there, the man was dead. Well, I got to thinking about this. Why did the adjustment of his thyroid level, he had been a little hypothyroid, under functioning of the thyroid, why did giving him some thyroid medicine and correcting his metabolism here on this and giving him a little bit more digitalis, why did that have a bad effect on him? So I decided, well, I think I'll go and talk with this old doctor and see what his evaluation is. And so I told him the whole scenario as it had developed from my end of it. And he said, well, he said, we learn a lot of things as we have experience in medicine. And one of the things that I have learned in my many years of practicing medicine is that when people are older, they need a reduction in their thyroid functioning. And the body will often bring the thyroid level down normally. And he said, what happens is, if you correct their deficiency in thyroid, you make the heart pump faster, because the thyroid, of course, revs up all of our metabolic systems. But the heart is a failing heart. It doesn't have the strength to carry that extra beat, that extra hard beat. And so it fails irrevocably. And that was what happened to him. Well, I had a lot of food for thought on that one. I was very, very sorry for my part in that whole episode. And since then, I felt that probably it is as the Lord made us. As we get older, we tend to have a diminution of thyroid function as a general rule. And that's good for us. All right, let's go on to this one. Annual meat eaters, extra health costs. I'm sure you can see that meat eating is expensive. It's an expensive food, and then it causes very expensive diseases. $24 billion in heart disease that we would not have if we just eliminated meat from our diet in the United States. $8.7 billion in hypertension, $18.8 billion in cancer, $4.6 billion in diabetes, $4.8 billion in gallstones. We could balance our national budget in a few years if we eliminated meat from our diet. It would be good for us from the standpoint of how we feel, too. Certainly, I feel much better than I did when my diet used to be principally meat, bread, white soda biscuits, and salads. That was what my lunches and dinners usually were, and I'm so glad I don't eat that way anymore. Okay, let's take some of the benefits of the vegetarian diet. Lower serum cholesterol, a third the risk of developing heart disease, less high blood pressure, less overweight, fewer calories, higher fiber. What does higher fiber do for us? That keeps us from getting cancer of the colon. So if you've got any other reason for that it increases you, that you have to increase your risk of cancer of the colon, as we studied this morning, then taking a high fiber diet would certainly be very helpful for you. And meat, milk, eggs, and cheese have not one molecule of fiber in them. Meat has fibrous connective tissue, but that's made of protein. It's not made of fiber, which is a carbohydrate. Lower incidence of cancer, less osteoporosis, fewer bowel problems, and of course it's quite a lot less expensive for us. Now let's take a look at something else. One of the ways to stay healthy may not be taking micronutrients such as vitamins and minerals. Here is a chart that shows the relationship of various minerals to each other. Vitamins have this same kind of relationship. If you alter one, then it's going to have a relationship on some others. If you alter calcium, it alters phosphorus. If phosphorus goes up in the blood, calcium has to go down, because if you elevate both of them at one time, that is not consistent with life if it goes up very much. So our divine designer has made us so that if the calcium goes up very much, we will excrete phosphorus. And so we may get what is called phosphate stones, kidney stones. Ever heard of phosphate kidney stones? Phosphate kidney stones may be caused by too much calcium, because it makes phosphate then go out in the urine. Zinc is one of the kingpins of minerals in the body. Notice how many other minerals have a relationship direct or indirect, with zinc. What are some zinc-high foods? Nuts and seeds, beans, whole grains. Those are zinc-high foods. Pumpkin seed, a very high zinc food. Yes, Brother Rhodes.
Are you telling us that taking vitamins on our own is not necessarily a happy solution?
Pastor Rose says, am I telling you that taking vitamins and minerals on your own may not be the ideal solution to your nutrient problems? And that is what I'm saying. That we are not good enough biochemists. We do not know the body well enough to be able to alter vitamins and minerals very much without getting into trouble. In this way, you see, if you take zinc, are you aware that there are some problems that are associated with taking too much zinc, too much calcium, too much copper, too much iron? All of these, if you take a lot of them, it can cause you to have serious problems with your health. And is it that these others as well, maybe cobalt, maybe nickel or chromium, maybe these as well have some untoward result from your taking too much of them? And so I don't know how to balance these nutrients in the body. And furthermore, I don't know anybody who does, because it's just not known. A lot of these things are just not known. And so my rule is this, that if a person feels that they truly should take some kind of vitamin or mineral supplement, that they take no more in a day than on a regular basis than the minimum daily requirement of that particular one. For instance, with vitamin C, that would be maybe 60 to 100 milligrams. And no more. And furthermore, that you not settle down to a long-term usage of vitamins and minerals, but that you limit it. You say, well, I may take this for 2 weeks or a month, but not for the duration of my life. Question here, and then one here. Since many of us are vegetarians, shouldn't we take some kind of B12 in particular? Well, there's a big controversy about this right now, and I don't know that I know the answer to that question. I will say this, that if you're a total vegetarian, you should become acquainted with the signs of B12 deficiency. In children, this is particularly critical. Usually you will have good signs that let you know that the person is likely to be getting B12 deficient. So you must watch for these signs and take good care of yourself. Then the other alternative is to take a B12 supplement. The kind that you should take, if you're going to take B12, is the chewable kind. The chewable kind, even the tablets that are not chewable, you can take it. It must stay in the... You can chew it and let it stay in contact with saliva for at least 2 minutes. 2 to 3 minutes gives you what is called the salivary factor, which assists B12 to be absorbed. For people who know they're B12 deficient, that can be of help to them. By the way, homocysteine tends to go up in people who are B12 deficient. Your question now. Yes. What about since we don't know the biochemistry well enough to be able to juggle these nutrients with supplements, what about such disorders as the bipolar states or states that alter serotonin and dopamine and whatever? Are we not on shaky grounds in trying to alter this? We may be, but let me give you another rule that I find helpful, and I think that you may think it to be reasonable, and that is that if a person has a demonstrated deficiency in a nutrient, let's say a demonstrated B12 deficiency or a demonstrated lithium deficiency, as they may have with a bipolar state, then the supplementation of that nutrient seems to me to be appropriate treatment. The same with the thyroid. If the thyroid does not produce enough thyroid hormone, it seems to me to be rational therapy to give them a thyroid supplement. And in any way that we have the technology to discover any of these things, it seems quite reasonable to me to supply the known lack there in this way. All right, now let's go to our next point, and that is, how do you lose weight? Let's say you're overweight and you want to lose weight. How do you do so? Now, here is the simplest way to lose weight that I have found. That is to alter your set point for weight. We have hundreds of set points in the body. We have set points for how much, how high the white blood cell count will go, how high the hemoglobin will go, how many hairs will grow on the head, how tall a person will get. And one of the set points that we have is how much a person can weigh. Now, you've all seen people who could just eat enormous quantities and not gain an ounce. And you may even have envied them and thought, oh, what a shame that they can eat so much and anything they want and not gain an ounce, and I can just look at food and gain weight. You may have thought that, but I want to tell you that it's better for you if you just eat a small amount, the smallest amount that you can get by with eating, the better it is for you. On the other hand, if your set point goes up, there are some things that you can do to get your set point to come down. Set point for weight, for most of us, we will reach that when we are about 25 years of age, and that's our ideal, that may be our ideal set point for weight. Certainly, if you considered yourself normal for your height and your muscular structure at the age of 25, then you're now 40 and your set point has been climbing with each pregnancy or with each passing year, you will be happy to know that there are some ways that you can bring the set point down. What causes the set point to slide upward? Well, we know a few things that will cause an upwardly mobile set point. One is the use of free fats. What are free fats? Well, margarine, butter, mayonnaise, fried foods, cooking fats, salad oils, and peanut butter. Does that mean then that you can't eat corn because it has corn oil in it and corn oil margarine comes from corn? No, you can eat corn. You can eat it plentifully because it has no free fat in it. What about if you can't eat peanut butter, can you eat peanuts? And the answer is yes, you can eat a few peanuts. Not a lot, because of course not any kind of nut, a lot of, because it does have calories, and calories do count certainly for the person who is overweight. If your set point starts down, then your calories don't count so much. It's a very interesting thing. Now, with free fats, apparently the control mechanism is located between the shoulder blades in an organ which most of you are probably unaware that even exists. It's called the brown fat organ. Brown fats we have known about for probably close to a century in animals. In bears that hibernate, they have a very well-developed brown fat. It helps them to store It alters their set point for weight at times that is necessary for them to store nutrients in preparation for their hibernation. For humans, we don't hibernate. So we knew we had the brown fat organ, but we just thought, well, it's not functional in humans. This we thought until about 10 or 15 years ago when the bariatric physicians, those that study overweight, began to recognize that there was a function for the brown fat in humans. What the brown fat does is that it sits up there and it watches every molecule that goes by in the bloodstream. So as the margarine goes by, it makes a note of that. Margarine is a very, very concentrated nutrient. It also sees the peanut butter and it sees the fried foods, and these very concentrated nutrients sort of stimulate the brown fat, and the brown fat says, ah, for all this concentrated food, we need to push the set point up just a little bit. So that's what it does. Sets the set point up. Now you will see down here another one that's called concentrated foods. Other concentrated foods are animal products. In fact, the non-concentrated foods are fruits, vegetables, whole grains. Those are the non-concentrated foods. All other foods are concentrated. All others. What are not concentrated? Fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. Everything else is concentrated. Especially the animal products tend to be both concentrated as well as stimulatory to weight gain. Milk, as an example, was designed by a loving creator who wanted to provide a diet that would make little animals grow. And so it does. It stimulates their growth. And then when you're no longer a little animal, it will still make you grow. You just grow in a different dimension. Milk also, you need to know, is diabetogenic. That means it promotes the development of diabetes. And of course, diabetes is always associated with overweight in the adult onset, or almost always. 80% of overweight adults will develop a metabolic profile resembling that of diabetes. So these are related to free fat. So make your foods less concentrated if you want your set point for weight to go down. Now what about the variety, the sheer variety of foods that you take at a meal? Again, there sits the brown fat up there watching every molecule. So it sees peas and carrots and lettuce and sees it all going by, and beets and okra and spinach, and oh, as it sees these things going by, whew, we'd better build a bigger warehouse to take care of all this extra nutrients. And so that's exactly what it does. It sends your set point up just a little bit so that you build a bigger warehouse and you get more fat cells that can store fat in them. Here's a question. I'm sure it's an important one. Nuts and legumes are concentrated foods. We do need some and we can eat some, but the answer to, I'm sure your question is, how much can we eat? And the answer is, be sparing with their use. All concentrated foods should be taken sparingly, whether it be animal products or nuts and seeds or things like salt. Salt is a concentrated food. Sugar is a concentrated food. So anything that's a concentrated food should be taken sparingly. If you've ever read Councils on Diet and Foods, you will recognize that the whole tenor of the counsel that we have from the Lord is concentrated food should be taken sparingly. One of the editorial captions in Councils on Diet and Foods, it has that very thing. Concentrated foods should be taken sparingly. So that's the word with that. Okay, I thought you were going to ask me another question. I thought somebody was going to ask me, why is it that I can eat peanuts, but I can't eat peanut butter? Anybody think of that one, that question? Well, there's a very good reason for that. And so I want to show you why. Here is the reason why. This is a fat molecule. You will see here that the artist has taken off the external layer of this fat globule to show you the internal structure here. But the particular thing that I want you to know is that if the fat comes with all this clothing on the outside, the duodenum, which must do the initial processing of fat, that's the first portion of the small bowel, the duodenum looks at this fat, this naked fat, if it does not have this clothing on it, and will say, ah, free fat. And so it stamps it with an apoprotein address label. That's what these are, address labels that will tell the fat where to get off in the bloodstream. If the globule of fat comes with all this clothing on it, it puts an entirely different apoprotein on the globule. Now, if it is unclothed, the duodenum says, ah, this is a fat molecule not ready to go to work. It must be ready to go to the playground. And so it lets the fat get off. It addresses it to get off at the hips or on the abdomen or in your heart valves or blood vessels or wherever. But if it comes with its business suit on, it says it's ready to go to work. Let's send it to the office. And so it puts a different apoprotein on it, and it goes to the liver or the muscles or some other place to participate in our body processes. Do you understand that difference? Why the free fat is the problem here in the set point. It's the free fat that has to do with the set point. Okay, let's take the next one. Exercise immediately after meals. The sooner after the meal, the better it is for you to get your set point down. So, immediately after the meal. My lunch partners today said, who wants to go for a walk? And I was so happy that they did. I was sorry that I couldn't go with them, but certainly that's the important thing to do right after a meal, is some kind of exercise. And ladies, we have that sort of built in housework of doing some work on the inside, but that could be a time when you could take a nice walk. That would be a good time for your exercise walk. If you have children, put your children in a stroller or take them by the hand and lead them right along. By the age of 3 or 4 years old, a child can walk as far as the parents if they are accustomed to doing so. Okay, let's see. Next, so what the person must do who has an upwardly mobile set point is to make a rule. Exercise right after meals and no food after 3 in the afternoon. The metabolism falls off along about 2:30 to 3:30. And so if you eat food after that, well, it tends to be stored in your fat. That's the second most important rule in getting your set point down. The first one is free fat. The second one is no food after 3 in the afternoon. Now, some people need a supper. Some people need a supper. How do you know if you are a person who needs supper? Is hunger a good way? No, hunger is not a good way. But my husband has a good test that will tell you whether you need a supper. He calls it the tape measure test. He just puts it right around the waist, just like this.
And then the tape measure tells him whether you need supper. Now the next thing is raw foods. Raw foods are better for you if you want to keep your set point down. Okay, any questions about the set points? This is the very easiest way to lose weight or to keep your weight down that I have found, both for myself personally as well as for my patients. Three questions. One, two, three, four. All right, number one. Okay. Should the diet be filled with an 80-20 raw to cooked? Some population groups that are very successful in living long do have that kind of relationship, like the Hunza cuts. So far as I know, it has never been researched in this country.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. International Copyright 2008, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministries.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. American Christian Ministries is not a one-man band. It is an orchestra of outstanding speakers, who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with our speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.